Hello, I'm Christine Milks. This is number 0342, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0342. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet filmmaker Leslie Udwin, whose controversial documentary, India's Daughter, touches on the aftermath of a murderous rape in India.
This is not an India-centric problem. This is a problem that plagues every single country around the globe. I am completely convinced that rape, just like child marriage, just like acid attacks and trafficking, these are all symptoms of a disease. And the disease is a mindset. The disease is the mindset of gender inequality. And as long as we have that mindset flourishing, nothing will change.
Filmmaker Ace Cruz on his journey towards independent filmmaking.
I read a book by Robert Rodriguez where he made a movie for $7,000 with his own money. So I was inspired by that book called Rebel Without a Cause. I said, hey, I can do this. You know, I have these entrepreneurial skills and business skills to be able to go out there and create my own destiny. So I said, I'll charge my credit card and get anyone that would like to donate, which I got my relatives to make the movie.
And we have lots and lots and lots of stuff. And of course, an idiot of the day, the guest Slater. The person who told you this was show number 0342 was Christine Milks, an office administrator in Gananoque, Ontario, and also a past Liberal candidate in the provincial Ontario riding of Leeds-Grenville. And if that isn't enough, she's also an absolutely sweetheart of a human being. She really is. Thank you very much, Christine, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a program that is also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? You know, we start off the Stuff File news by bringing out the comedic side of the Grim Reaper, because once again, we have the latest edition of the Darwin File, because as you know, the tree of life is often self-pruning. A Washington state man was killed when he shot himself in the face with a .45 caliber handgun while taking selfies. The 43-year-old man and his girlfriend were photographing themselves with the weapon at a residence in the town of Concrete on Sunday when he shot himself. Now, according to Patrol Chief Chad Clark, both of them had been taking pictures throughout the day. He'd been kind of modeling with the gun, pointing it towards himself on occasion, always loading it and unloading it. What we determined so far is that during his last go-around, he didn't realize that he had one in the chamber when he pulled the trigger and it went off. The distraught girlfriend ran over to the neighbors, who called police. By then, unfortunately, the time when the officers arrived, the man was dead. The death is being investigated as accidental, and there is no indication drugs or alcohol may have played a role, said Clark. The man's name has not been released. You know, it's interesting that there is a catch-all term for such deaths as accidental. But don't you think it's time that another category be created? Because there are just some deaths out there that are clearly moronic in nature. This is just more than accidental. And that's the Darwin File. Now, I've been sharing odd stories, odd news stories on radio shows for the better part of 25 years, and it never ceases to amaze me how this next story of mistaken phone numbers always seems to have the exact same outcome. Jackson County, Mississippi sent out summonses ordering at least 350 residents to be ready to report for jury duty. They were directed to call a toll-free number the night before to see if they had to report. But the number that was printed was wrong. It was actually for a sex chat line. In these stories, it's always a sex chat line. Anyway, the local newspaper reported that the adult service was equal opportunity because callers were directed to press 1 if they were male and 2 if they were female. Circuit court clerk Randy Carney says he found out about the problem when the judge called him at home. He said an outside company prepared the documents and noted he did not try calling the number. Hopefully, he added, no one did that. Well, clearly, the reporter did that. It would seem that everyone's toll-free number is just one digit removed from a sex line. Funny how that always happens, huh? Anyway, Steve Shapiro and Bob Weiss, who are both 71 years old, they bought a yacht in Norway and set off to sail across the Atlantic. After 9 rescues, that's right, 9 rescues by emergency crews in Norway, Denmark, Ireland, and the UK, they are now stranded in Hale, England. Now, Shapiro faces a $14,000 repair bill and may be aborting the trip. I'm not a serious explorer, Shapiro admits. I'm more of a playboy. The latest incident? A blaze started by a candle left burning when the men went on shore. It brought scolding from Sir Robin Knox Johnson, the first person to sail nonstop around the globe. This is no longer a joke, he said. They need to show a greater sense of responsibility and, frankly, either pack it in or, I hate to say it, get the hell out of our waters as soon as possible. Interesting. You know, normally at 71, it's usually a romantic idea to sail off into the sunset. This is not one of those cases. And you know, as human beings, we often have a nostalgic feeling for items in our past, but that can occasionally go too far. 68-year-old retired engineer Harry Littlewood watched workers tear down outdated public housing in Stockport, England recently, and rushed over to ask the local Stockport Council about recovering a souvenir, since the teardowns included the residence that he grew up in. The council agreed, and Littlewood was awarded the toilet that he had used as a boy. I never thought I'd see it again, he mused. I never thought someone would think about saying, I never thought I'd see a toilet again, but anyway, there you go. He said he would probably turn it into a planter. You know, there are some things that perhaps you should just simply let go. Flush it out of your life, as it were. Yeah. Australian Neville Sharp brought his A game to a pub in the Darwin suburb of Humpty Doo. Yes, there is a Darwin suburb named Humpty Doo. I kid you not. This story took place in February, and in a Guinness World Record attempt, he expelled a 110.6 decibel belch, which, if certified by Guinness Book officials, beats the old record of 109.9 by a gentleman in the UK. Sharp gives all credit to his sister for teaching him, as a child, proper belching technique. Gee, it's really nice to have lofty goals in life, isn't it? Certainly much loftier than trying to retrieve a toilet from your past, I guess, but I digress. Anyway, let's get to one more Stuff File story before we get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. This next story historically comes from the truly bizarre Ideas File. Now, according to a former spy for the Soviet Union, dictator Joseph Stalin so distrusted his communist China counterpart, Mao Zedong, that during the 1940s, when Mao visited the USSR, Soviet engineers arranged to capture his bowel movements so that Stalin's scientists could examine them chemically to form a psychological profile. I think that needs repeating. Stalin had Soviet engineers capture his bowel movements so that scientists could examine them chemically to form a psychological profile. Now, who in their right mind first came up with this idea? That's what I'd like to know. But anyway, let's go on. Spy Igor Adamenko found evidence that other world leaders received similar treatment. So it's not just Mao's dung that they were looking at. Among the indicators, high levels of the amino acid tryptophan signaled the person was calm and approachable, and lack of potassium portended nervousness and insomnia. Okay, imagine being a scientist in the Soviet Union in the 1940s. You're called in by higher-ups because they feel you're the right person to conduct top-secret experiments and tests. Imagine your glee when you learn you're about to do something great for your country. Imagine your reaction when you discover what that job actually is. Imagine realizing just how secure your place in the country's history will be. Oh joy, oh bliss. Yeah. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program, shall we? Leslie Udwin is the documentary filmmaker behind the controversial BBC film India's Daughter about the 2012 fatal gang rape of a woman in New Delhi. The film includes an interview with one of the rapists who blamed women. India's Daughter was banned last year from being shown in India. Leslie Udwin is on the line with us via Skype right now from the Sun Valley, Idaho area. Hi, Leslie.
Hi, Peter.
Thanks for being on the program with us.
Thank you for having me. This is such an important issue. I'm very happy to be with you.
Now, we all saw the news, and at the time that the story was big in the news, I was a television news anchor, so we were covering it on a regular basis. And it's harrowing to see what was going on. It had to be even worse when you decided to delve into it and talk to several of the people involved in this story.
Yes, well, in fact, surprisingly enough, Peter, it wasn't the gang rape itself or the horrific detail of that motivated me to go there. It was actually the response to that gang rape. It was seeing these extraordinary numbers of men and women, and I must stress men and women, who poured out onto the street. This was the most admirable, exciting, awe-inspiring display of, you know, a momentous passion. This was civil society coming out in force to say, we've had enough. We're not putting up with this anymore. We will not have our women treated this way. And that's what moved me. I'd never seen any country in the world come out with so much, you know, robust and courageous passion. So it was the optimism and the feeling that actually change was on the horizon that made me actually go out there, not the darkness of the gang rape.
But even though there is, as you say, so much optimism right now, there still is a big problem, isn't there?
Oh, yes. And I wouldn't say there's optimism now. There was optimism then. It appeared with that robust response to that particular crime, that change was at hand. Unfortunately, that kind of passion doesn't last long. And it died out after, well, an admirable month and a half, which is the longest anyone's ever protested for women and girls' rights in the world. But it did die out. And the rapes have continued relentlessly, not just in India, but across the whole world. This is not, it's very important to stress, this is not an India-centric problem. This is a problem that plagues every single country around the globe. And, you know, I am completely convinced, Peter, that rape, just like child marriage, just like acid attacks and trafficking, these are all symptoms of a disease. And the disease is a mindset. The disease is the mindset of gender inequality. And as long as we have that mindset flourishing, nothing will change.
Okay, but you talk about that mindset. Let's go back a little bit to what you said brought you into this story in the first place, and that was the outpouring, the positive outpouring of people, both men and women, coming together to try to change this. Is it not possible that even though you said that passion has died down a bit, the mere fact that it took place must be an awakening to some people that there are others like-minded who think in the right way and that they're not alone in their thinking.
It is an incremental step, but there have been incremental steps for decades. You know, Beijing 20 years ago was an incremental step. But what has happened since Beijing? Are we there? Have we solved the problem of violence against women? Absolutely not. It goes on relentlessly and unabated. I believe there is only one way to actually solve this problem, and that is to have a system change in education. I think education is the only way to change a mindset. And when I say education, I'm not talking about access to education. I'm not talking about getting more kids into school, important as that is. I'm talking about what it is we teach our children. And we have been, I believe, highly irresponsible as a world. We have let the world's children down in a pretty despicable fashion, if I'm honest. Where have we bothered to nurture their hearts, to teach them respect for others, to teach them social-emotional learning and perspective-taking and critical thinking and problem-solving and respect and empathy? We haven't bothered. We are just concentrating on numeracy and literacy and educating their heads and ignoring the education of their hearts. And I think it is not until we stand up as a world and take responsibility for the fact that we have neglected the third crucially important missing dimension to the system of education and overhaul that and actually introduce a new subject into the world's schools with the same degree of respect and time and attention as mathematics. If it's compulsory for a child to learn mathematics in order to lead a good and productive life, it should be compulsory for a child to learn the value of another human being and the value of him or herself.
Okay, but you mentioned Beijing, and I want to differentiate between Beijing and India, in that Beijing China is still somewhat of a closed society where the government controls the media and therefore the word. Doesn't some of this have to come from within, and I'm talking about from within the various countries? Isn't the difference with India the fact that there is a little bit more of a freer society when it comes to media, although your film has been banned there? Isn't the word getting out of what has taken place from a groundswell or a grassroots movement to try and stop what has been taking place in India and getting out to the rest of the population because there's a media that will cover it?
Well, clearly not, because look at the rapes that continue on a daily basis. You know, 2-year-olds, 4-year-olds, gang raped. It's not making a difference. And as you yourself have said, you know, India has banned this film. It doesn't want to look in the mirror. But the film is making an enormous amount of difference in terms of awareness, which again is incremental steps globally. The film is birthing activists. It is transforming individuals. So it is doing its work in the countries where it is being shown. And by the way, when I mentioned Beijing, I didn't mean to refer in any way to China or what goes on in China, but I was referring, of course, to the very famous conference of women in Beijing, you know, where Hillary Clinton made that famous and eloquent speech saying, women's rights are human rights. And there was a massive wave of optimism. I was comparing that to the optimism I witnessed with this mass protest at this gang rape in India.
I know, but the point I was bringing up is that she made that speech there, unfortunately, to a country that wouldn't get a chance to hear it.
But she was making the speech to the world, Peter.
True.
She wasn't making it specifically to China, addressing a Chinese problem. This is not a national problem in any country. It is a world global epidemic.
So where do we go to from here? I mean, you've made this movie. It's getting to be seen. We're talking about it. You travel around talking about it. What has to be done next?
Well, I'm doing what has to be done next, or at least what I perceive and believe with all my heart has to be done next. I have committed myself to an education initiative called Think Equal. And it's about a week or two before our website is up, but please, I hope the listeners will go to it and remember to go to it in a week or two. We have constituted a committee of world visionaries and experts, the top brains in the field of social emotional learning, Dr. Mark Brackett and Dr. Robin Stern from the Yale Center of Emotional Intelligence, with whom we've partnered, Mary Gordon from Roots of Empathy, who is the world expert on empathy, amazing people from around the globe, Dr. Urvashi Sani from India, who works with the Brookings Institute as a fellow, some Ashoka fellows, and we are going to construct and design a detailed, tangible, concrete curriculum of 2 hours a week of social emotional education. And we're asking education ministers around the world to co-opt this onto their national curricula as a new subject on a compulsory basis and from the first day of entry of a child into school. We have 28 countries so far committed to participating in this. And this is what will change the world. And I believe it's the only thing that will change the world. And in fact, it's a human rights education initiative. It's not just a gender equality initiative, because the truth is, Peter, that it's the same impulse that makes six men go and gang rape a woman and toss her naked and bleeding off a moving bus to die on the roadside, as makes one tribe go and try and annihilate another because it's a tribe of no value. It's a question of ascribing value. It's what makes ISIS go and behead people who are of a valueless religion. Empathy needs to be taught and it needs to be practiced. Perspective taking, compassion, these are not things we can just, on a wing and a prayer, hope that people will somehow find their way to or leave it to the parents. The parents are old learners. The parents themselves have cycles of violence to deal with. And when I sat with these seven rapists for 31 hours, it was completely apparent to me, utterly obvious and searingly clear, that these men had been programmed. These were not monsters who were aberrant in nature and just, you know, freaks who did this sort of thing. They were programmed to do what they did. They had been handed a set of attitudes from the day they were born that told them that women were subordinate, they were of lesser value, there were specific rules they had to adhere to, like not going out after dark. And, you know, if you've seen the film, the rapist says she was out after dark, she broke the diktats of patriarchal society, she deserved to be taught a lesson.
Okay, so hold that thought. I need to take a quick break. I'd like to talk to you a little bit more about this. We're talking with Leslie Udwin, who is the filmmaker behind the movie India's Daughter. We'll take a quick break on the Stuff File program and we'll continue.
You're listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander Show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of the Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick, if you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
Actors, authors, quirky guests, and the common folk. It all comes to you here on the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
And we are continuing to talk with Leslie Udwin, who is the documentary filmmaker behind the controversial BBC film India's Daughter. And you were talking before the break, Leslie, about the men that were responsible for this rape, and you had a chance to talk to in jail. Do you feel, because they're now behind bar, do you feel there was any hope for these guys? Can they be retrained? Can they be rehabilitated? Is it possible from such a heinous mindset?
No, I don't believe it is possible. And I wish I could say I did. But, you know, that is why partly I believe the solution is to start with a clean slate and to start with children as young as 2 and 3. Neuroscience actually tells us, Peter, that the age, the window during which a child is cognitively modifiable, in other words, the window at which they can change attitude and behavior, is between the ages of 3 and 5. And that is an absolutely crucial time. Now, these kids at 3 and 5, these rapists, have seen their fathers beat their mothers, have seen violence be absolutely a common part of their lives. It's normalized. You know, when I went out there, the media had told me, as it had all of us who read about this case, that these men were monsters. And that's what I was expecting. I was also expecting to be utterly enraged and furious with them, so much so that I decided that I had better practice on other rapists before I got to the rapists in this case. And the reason for that is that I was raped myself when I was 18. And I thought that all these ghosts would kind of emerge in me, and I might just even physically assault one of them. I was really, really frightened of that. If I tell you, I didn't feel one second of anger as I sat for 31 hours with these 7 men, one of whom, the one, you know, I had practiced on, had raped a 5-year-old girl. And I had left a 13-year-old daughter behind when I went out to make this film. So you can imagine, I didn't feel anger, and they expressed no remorse, which was the other thing I expected, was that they would at least have a glimmer of remorse or regret. Now, why is that? Well, put all those factors together.
Well, let me ask you a question. The thing that keeps coming to my mind, and I don't know if you asked this question of these men, but, and I think you already answered it earlier when you talked about their background, but how do they feel about their own mothers?
Well, they respect their mothers because their mothers are in a role that patriarchal society has prescribed for women. You see, there are good women and bad women. Mukesh tells us, in their view, there are good women and there are bad women. And he says only 20% of women are good. Now, you know, that society teaches him to look at a girl who is wearing a particular dress that is not traditional dress code and label her as a slut, label her as somebody who deserves what she gets, okay? Or look at a woman who is out at night with a boy, and that boy is neither her husband nor her brother. She deserves to be raped because she's clearly asking for it. Do you see, this is the mindset. They can't. It's a default with them. It's so deeply ingrained. They can't be reformed at at this stage in their lives. Everything that they have witnessed and evidenced has brought them to the same conclusion. And they feel no remorse. This is the crucial thing for us to understand, because they genuinely don't believe they've done wrong. Because everything they've learned has told them, well, she deserved it. And you see how he justifies himself in this film.
Okay, so they're raising boys to think this way. How are they raising the girls? Are there women who actually agree with this philosophy?
Oh, yes. Look at the rapist's wife in the film, who says, when my husband is hanged, I will choke my son, I will strangle him, and I will kill myself. Because a woman is only here to live for a man. She says it explicitly. And I have to tell you, this was quite a feisty and intelligent woman. I was surprised by how intelligent she was. The women are programmed along with the men. Of course they are.
Is part of the problem from the rest of the world, from Western society, the fact that sometimes Western society looks down at other parts of the world as being backwards and not worthy of the problems, of dealing with the problems that they may be facing? That, as you mentioned, this is indeed a global problem, but a lot of people aren't looking at it as one.
Well, they certainly should be looking at it as one. And I have to say, I have much admired audiences around the world who have come to see my film, and all, you know, I've shown it several times in the States, and they are very, very willing to put their hands up and say, we have the same problem. We have 1 in 4 girls on college campuses who are raped. We have had this problem in the military, and still do, I'm sure. We haven't even got in this country the Equal Rights Amendment Act ratified. There's no equal pay for women who do equal work to men. Women of color are paid even less. So you see, it is a disease that is global and is even in the so-called highly developed and democratized countries. We're not immune from this. And I think what it really comes down to is the fact that society has been, since time immemorial, patriarchal. The power, the entitlement has been with the men. And we are slowly moving in the direction of increasing, for example, the representation of women on boards of companies, but we're still at a pathetic 9%. We're slowly increasing the representation of women in parliament, but we're nowhere near equality. And this is the problem.
You get to travel around. You obviously are a strong advocate of this issue globally. Is there a spot in the world someplace that you can say is closer to the utopia that you hope and wish for the rest of the world? Is there a place where equality seems to work?
Not that I've seen yet. And the place that I would have hoped would have been closest was Sweden. I was there recently, very honored to receive a human rights award there, one that my role model and heroine, Madeleine Albright, one of my heroines, had won a couple of years ago. And I went there, I thought I had died and gone to paradise, because this award was given in the parliament, and the parliamentarians were telling me that Sweden is a feminist government with a feminist foreign policy. I couldn't believe my ears. And that's how they present themselves to the people. And I thought, well, things have to be better here. Are they? No, they're not. Violence against women is an epidemic in Sweden too. So, you know, equally, having said that, this is a very new government. It's only been in place for a number of months. And maybe there is a way. Maybe in a couple of years we'll say, well, Sweden didn't do it with education, but they've certainly improved it through parliamentary routes. I don't know, because this is so new, you know, to have a government proclaim itself to have feminist policies. But certainly, I don't think there's a single place on earth that is free of this problem. It is just a question of degree and characteristic country to country. So if you're in Saudi Arabia and you're a woman and you drive a car, you'll be arrested and imprisoned. We can drive a car here. We can drive a car in the UK. But in the UK, one in three girls between 13 and 17 have experienced sexual violence. It's another face of the same problem.
It is indeed. I want to mention your film one more time. The movie is called India's Daughter. It's a very important film. For those who haven't seen it and would like to, what's the best way of finding out how to see your movie?
Vimeo On Demand. And Vimeo, I'm sure people know of, but it's like video, only spelt with an M. Vimeo On Demand, India's Daughter. And we have a website which please visit, www.indiasdaughter.com.
Leslie, thank you very, very much for taking the time to talk with us on this very important issue. And continued success in all that you do.
Thank you so much, Peter, and thank you for focusing on this crucial issue.
Documentary filmmaker Leslie Udwin. Her film is India's Daughter. You can find out more info by going to the website indiasdaughter.com. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0342, and you'll find the link. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo-Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. The business of filing lawsuits, fighting lawsuits, and paying for lawsuits is a major part of the American economy. The direct costs alone, even excluding things like the tobacco settlement and some classes of lawsuits, are almost 2% of the country's gross domestic product. However, law firms don't publicize their financial balance sheets like other industries, so the public has been denied most of the information it needs to understand what's really going on in the world of litigation. But now, a respected think tank called the Manhattan Institute has released a new report on lawsuits in America. It's called Trial Lawyers Incorporated, and it resembles an annual report on the litigation industry. Let's be fair. Americans spend $589 billion every year on lawsuits that we wouldn't have to spend if the level of litigation here was just the same as it is in other countries we're competing with for jobs. This report exposes the lawsuit industry in a way that's easy to understand. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamericatv.org.
Hi, this is Wynonna Judd, and you probably don't think of me as a person with an eating disorder. But here's my truth. Eating disorders are real, and they are not just about losing weight. Eating disorders are the way you feel about your body and the way you treat yourself. For years, I have been a compulsive overeater, and it wasn't until its effects threatened my health, my family, and my career that I finally reached out for help. Recovering from an eating disorder is possible, and I'm living proof. But you have to take the first step, so I urge you to visit nationaleatingdisorders.org.
You're listening to the Stuff File program. It's the choice of 4 out of 5 dentists. The 5th dentist also listens, but that's just because he follows the crowd. Here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll meet filmmaker Ace Cruz. Plus, we also have an idiot of the day coming your way. But right now, we have much more Stuff File news right here, right now, on a program also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, according to a February story in the student newspaper, several students at the Ivy League's Brown University complained that classroom work, ostensibly what Brown charges $50,000 a year in tuition for, was increasingly a burden, distracting them from their more important calling, organizing and protesting against various injustices on campus. Students were underperforming academically and suffering health problems and anxiety issues because, said the students, Brown still expects them to complete course requirements even though they were busy denouncing racist columns in the student newspaper and challenging the weakness of Brown's diversity policies, among other targets. Yes. Oh, the difficult first world issues that plague academia. Perhaps we should start a telethon or a crowdsourcing. Yes, poor little dears. The three young men charged so far in the February 17th murder in a South Carolina bowling alley made their first post-crime courtroom appearance memorable ones. According to a local television news report, 22-year-old Albert Taylor, whom police labeled as the shooter, seemed indifferent to the charges, but questioned the judge about courtroom cameras appearing preoccupied. As he was being ushered out, he turned to address the camera and barked, "What's up, y'all? You can follow me on Twitter, follow me on Instagram, Snapchat." This brings me to an interesting question. If you are in jail awaiting trial, and also if you're in jail after conviction, should you even be allowed on Twitter, Instagram, or Snapchat? Just asking. Anyway, four Idaho teenagers suspected of setting fire to their high school principal's house in retaliation for being suspended have been taken into custody. Payette Police Chief Mark Clark said that one boy's family brought him to authorities Thursday after the other three were detained Wednesday in the city of about 7,500 people. Clark says two boys were charged with first-degree arson and conspiracy to commit arson, while the others were charged with conspiracy. They were being held in juvenile detention on $200,000 bond each. Investigators believe three high schoolers and one middle schooler started the February 22nd blaze that destroyed the home of Payette High School principal Mark Heliker and three cars parked in the driveway. No one was injured. Clark has said social media posts helped lead investigators to the boys. So, not only has these morons' plight gotten worse than a simple suspension, their crime came undone because of their use of social media. Classic. Simply classic. The robbers of the electronics store CompuCell in Springfield, Massachusetts in December came up empty, but are still at large. A man with a gun jumped the counter and demanded that the employee give him money from the locked cash register. The gunman moved to the back door to let in the accomplice that he had, but that merely allowed the employee and two customers to run out the front door, and the accomplice fled too, sensing that, with no one to unlock the register, the robbery was going nowhere. Again, another case of lack of proper planning. And you know, every metropolis is working hard to get their citizens to take more public transit, but perhaps they should change the wording. They want people to use more public transit, not take more public transit. According to police in Minnesota, a man was arrested on a charge of theft after allegedly stealing a public transportation bus because he wanted to get to work. The Hennepin County Sheriff's Office said that they have arrested 31-year-old Gregory John Jenrich after being accused of taking the Metro Transit bus that was parked at a gas station and driving it to work. Here's the best part, by the way. Jenrich actually works as a mechanic for Metro Transit. If convicted, he faces up to 5 years in prison and a fine of up to $10,000. Now, according to the police investigation, the operator of the bus was on a break at the Holiday gas station when the bus was stolen. You know, I'll bet his lawyer, Jenrich's lawyer, by the way, is who I'm referring to. I'll bet Jenrich's lawyer will try to say that the bus was just lost and that Jenrich was bringing it back home. Yeah. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, a southern New Jersey man has been found guilty of stabbing his downstairs neighbor to death in a dispute over pet birds. Camden County prosecutors say 65-year-old David Giordano was convicted of aggravated manslaughter in the slaying of 52-year-old Michael Taylor. The Voorhees Township man had been Taylor's upstairs neighbor. Prosecutors say Giordano poured water on Taylor's pet birds because they were chirping too loudly. The birds had been kept on Taylor's porch. Giordano then repeatedly stabbed Taylor with a knife when Taylor confronted him. Taylor died of his injuries at a hospital nearly 3 weeks later. Giordano faces 15 to 30 years in state prison. Now let's hope that in jail he's put in a cell with someone who is the equivalent of the Birdman from Alcatraz. Yeah. Anyway, let's get to our next guest, shall we? Ace Cruz is an actor and filmmaker in Los Angeles who is making his mark in the independent film world. He has been the driving force behind six films so far through his Spirit Films, movies that are commercial and with a positive message. Ace joins us via Skype from L.A. Hi, Ace.
Hi, I'm happy to be here.
Thanks for being on the program with us. As I mentioned in the introduction, you try to make films that that have a positive message. What was the whole idea behind wanting to do that?
Well, I've always been a very spiritual person, and I always wanted to give and give back to the world. So I guess that's my one way of getting good karma, in a sense, you know, my charity towards helping living in a place to have the world to be in a better place.
Now, you started out as an actor, and you indeed act in your films, but you actually, if I'm not mistaken, went back to school to learn to direct, correct?
That's right. After I graduated from the USC BFA acting program with my four-year degree, I started doing stage plays at first. And I go, well, you know, I couldn't make money doing these stage plays that I was acting in, that I should preserve them. So I went back to making movies. I went back into learning how to make movies and start creating content on, you know, for the world and inspiring messages that I want to put into my USC. So I was actually at USC for 8 years.
So you come out of USC, you decide to direct movies. The first one you did, you starred and directed in a film made with your own money called Last Chance, a.k.a. Gangstas, which co-starred Todd Bridges, as everyone will know from Different Strokes, and also Judy Ann Santos, correct?
That's correct. Judy Ann Santos has to be one of the famous stars over there in the Philippines. I don't know if most of the Filipinos would know who she is.
Okay, so making this movie with your own money, a daring idea.
Well, I read a book by Robert Rodriguez where he made a movie for $7,000 with his own money. So I was inspired by that book called Rebel Without a Cause. And I said, hey, I can do this. You know, I have these entrepreneurial skills and business skills to be able to go out there and create my own destiny. So I said, I'll charge my credit card and get anyone that would like to donate, which I got my relatives, to make the movie.
So you get this done. What kind of budget are we talking about for this first film you made?
We were looking at $10,000 on this, my very first film. And I was going to USC Film School at that time, and people were making 10-minute shorts for that amount of money. And I said, you know what? I'll make a whole feature film, because the first digital camera just came out, called the Sony VX100, I think is what we used. Bruce, what was that? 1000, Sony VX1000. It was the first video camera that was very similar to Super 16 or 16 millimeter during that time when I was going to film school. And I said, wow, instead of spending money on film stock or processing everything just be on tape.
Okay, so what year are we talking about?
1996 is when I started that film.
Okay, so...
Oh, by the way, Bruno Mars's sister, Jamie Bay, Bruno Mars was 6 years old at that time, and an interesting story, she had asked me if I had a role for her six-year-old brother, which was Bruno Mars. Now Bruno's his big star. I wish I had put him in during that time.
Okay, so you didn't find a part for Bruno, is that what you're saying?
No, I didn't. I wish I could have. I didn't know he was going to be a big star and, you know, became Bruno Mars. But during that time, he was just only 6 years old, and he was an Elvis Presley impersonator.
Okay, well, so we're going back to 1996. That's the first film. You've done, as I said, in total six films since then. Your biggest to date, I understand, was film number four, which was called Fate, which had Lee Majors in it, the $6 Million Man.
Yeah.
And
right.
You know, I mentioned Todd Bridges. Sam Jones was also in one of your films. Lee Majors is in this film, also along with Philip Michael Thomas. Again, they're low budget independent films. How do you manage to get the talent you get for these pictures?
Well, a lot of times, you know, it's through referrals, it's through networking, it's through people that know them and have a relationship with them. And it's build one relationship from let's say, the American film market where I'm selling these movies, and they'd say, hey, this one is available. Now, when I do a casting call, a lot of people who are not working at that time, also their agents start submitting to me because, you know, it was a SAG film. And I mean, I had Mark Hamilton submit to me, you know, the agents. And I think who else I had for the leading lady, I had really, who are big stars now, they weren't as big then. It was just the luck of the draw that I got these actors in different ways. You know, it really is through connections, through agents. I put a casting breakdown and they submit.
Okay, so again, low budget movies, independent films. Where do you get the opportunity? Because one of the things when you're literally a one man band or at least a couple of people band as you are, there's the production of the film, there's the editing of the film, but there's also the marketing and viewing of the film. Of the various aspects of filmmaking that you have to deal with, what for you is the most difficult aspect to wrap yourself around to help to make your film successful?
I think the most hardest is raising the money. I had to always raise the money with private investors, angel investors to come in, because some of these films went up to $1 million. You know, Fate was about $1 million to make, you know, with that cast. And then my earlier films, you know, when you're starting out, you're making movies for $10,000, $20,000. And my very first film, I made a profit and I sold it in the American film market. And during that time, I think it was Boys in the Hood that was a big success. And Last Chance was very similar to that genre, you know, Boys in the Hood. So I kind of rode along the fame of Boys in the Hood in 1996. So from there, it led me from other investors. So they would give me more money because it made money. And then someone would give me $100,000 to make a movie. And I said, okay, I'll make a movie. And I sort of pick what type of movies I have to make, so in order to make a profit for the DVD market.
Now, your sixth film, the most recent one you made, was called Outrage, correct?
That's correct.
And that starred Michael Madsen. When did that come out?
That was in 2010 when it came out, I believe. And Michael Madsen, we had Natasha Lyonne, who's now in the new Orange is Black, and Michael Berryman in that film. And that was a film that caused me to become good friends with Michael Madsen. So a lot of times I put him in my films, and we went to the Philippines for 6 weeks promoting that film during that time.
Where do your films primarily show?
Oh, straight to DVD, because that's what I designed those films for. There were genre films to go to DVD, and then now I'm working on doing theatrical films. So I would say those were my training ground in making movies for Hollywood.
Well, that was actually my next question. What are you working on next? What's your next big project?
Well, the next one I'm working on is called Fight for Life, and it is an action drama that takes place in Cambodia, Vietnam, and the United States.
And where do you get the ideas? Do you have script writers? Do you write the scripts yourself? Where do the ideas or inspirations for your films come from?
Some of the scripts come from me. You know, I write the one I'm doing right now, I'm writing myself. I have been doing a lot of research on it. And then after that, I bring in A-list, you know, script writers, consultants, to make sure that it's solid and it's marketable.
You're not worried about spreading yourself too thin?
No. As my films get bigger and bigger, I now start allocating everyone to do their job. I'll hire the screenwriter, right? I'll hire the editor. Right now, I just concentrate on directing it. And I bring in a producer, because the budgets are much bigger. When you're doing smaller budget movies, you have to do everything yourself to give the quality and to keep the standard high.
So now you're working on a film, as you mentioned, called Fight for Life. When will that be available? When will that be out?
Well, we're still in development right now. I'm still actually writing the script. I'm in the third act trying to get the conclusion. And once that's done, then I start packaging it together and then start budgeting and then start casting. People can go on the Facebook, on my Facebook, and they see the updates there under Ace Cruz.
And you also have a website, if I'm not mistaken, spiritfilmsllc.com, correct?
Yeah, that's my production company, spiritfilmsllc.com, where we do feature films.
Ace, continued success in what you do. It seems like you get a chance to stay a little bit under the radar, but you're getting your films out there, and it only leads to bigger and better things as time goes on. You know, just recently, we saw the Spirit Film Awards take place, the Independent Film Awards take place. Is that a goal for you down the road?
Oh, yes, absolutely. We were just talking with a team of writers today, talking about, you know, where we want to make inspiring films that are compelling, that can go to these awards. Of course, that's where we want to be able to tackle. We want to make a great film. That's all my whole objective is, and so we can share it to these type of festivals.
Well, continued success with all you do, Ace. Thank you very much for being on the program with us.
Thank you very much for being on. I'm honored.
Independent filmmaker Ace Cruz. You can find out more info by going to his website or Facebook page, and you can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for the show, which is show number 0342, and you'll find those links. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Time now for The Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for The Strange Things Adults Do. The Stuff File presents The Idiot of the Day.
38-year-old Alex Smith asked a sheriff's deputy in Limestone County, Alabama, at 3 a.m. on February 19th for a courtesy ride to a nearby Walmart, and the deputy agreed, but following procedure, said he would have to search Smith before letting him into the patrol car, and according to the subsequent arrest report, Smith needed the ride and consented. The deputy then turned up a veritable drug supply store in Smith's pockets, his backpack, and his duffel bags. Drugs, including meth, marijuana, and black tar heroin, two syringes, a drug cooking spoon, two marijuana pipes, a meth smoking pipe, and a supply of baggies of the type frequently used for drugs. Smith was charged with drug possession and trafficking. Now, why? Oh, why? When clearly you have crammed every drug device into every compartment of your being, would you ask a police officer for a ride and then voluntarily offer up to be searched before getting that ride? Well, one reason, and one reason only. You're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of The Stuff File program number 0342. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links and all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0342. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder, and don't forget to check out The Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberstationUSA.com, GDPR in Nashville, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded in iTunes and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Guests of The Stuff File program stay at their own homes. Trust me, I'm the voice for this program. I know there's no budget for accommodations. I'm reading this on a futon.